We'd better start our luncheon session in as much as we're going to run out of time otherwise. Can I be heard? Can you hear me? Good. I first met Peggy Fletcher Stack in the 1980s when she was editor of Sunstone. Sunstone, she says, was her first great love. First chronologically, but not necessarily in order of importance, since her second great love is her husband, Mike, a freelance documentary filmmaker, and that great love includes their children, Jamie, Suzanne, and Karen. Her background: University of Utah, where she was one of Sunstone's founders, Berkeley, where she studied theology at the Union Seminary, New York, where she was associated with a think tank on medical ethics, all excellent preparations for her present career, journalism. Peggy possesses a penetrating intellect, an incisive wit, and a deep and abiding spirituality. She is soft-spoken and disarmingly persuasive. As Monsignor Stoffel of Salt Lake City once said, "I find I can never say no to anything Peggy asks me to do." Well, now, what Peggy has asked me to do is be brief. So, with great pleasure, I now turn the time over to Peggy Fletcher Stack.
It's really a pleasure to be here in California, nice warm weather. Although I really hate leaving my family, even on a short trip like this, I've been thinking a lot in the last while about Mark Hoffman. It being 10 years since the murders of October 15th, 1985. I've thought about how my life has changed and what I've learned from him and what I will carry from that experience for the next decade and how that might change. So I titled my remarks today, "What Mark Hoffman Taught Me About Journalism, History, and Scripture." When I was a child, I had a profound respect for the printed word. My parents were big readers, both of books and newspapers. They subscribed to many magazines and journals. They complained of bias in the New York Times and so supplemented it with the Newark Star Ledger, which they proclaimed was objective. I just loved them all indiscriminately. I even had quizzes in high school taken from the New York Times as if it were a textbook. In 1985, when Mark Hoffman was dealing in forged documents and with frighteningly cold, calculated murder, I was not a journalist. I was still a voracious consumer of news and a participant in newsmaking events. Like many of you, I was intrigued by Mark's purported document finds. As editor of Sunstone, I was guilty of feeding the frenzy surrounding the so-called Salamander letter. At the Salt Lake 1984 and 1985 symposia sessions on the documents filled hotel ballrooms, which in turn helped fill Sunstone coffers. Not that we ever got rich from it. October 15th, 1985. 3 days earlier, I was married in Salt Lake City, Salt Lake Temple. Several of the players in the Mark Hoffman fiasco were invited to my wedding reception. Hugh Pinnock came, Steve Christensen did not. Mike and I left for our honeymoon in southern Utah. 3 days, glorious days, unforgettable days, we did not read the newspaper. We left on a Saturday, came home Tuesday morning. I called to work to tell them I would be late. Scott Dunn answered the phone. I said, "Scott, I'm going to be late." He said, "Have you seen the newspapers?" I said, "No, why? Did President Kimball die?" And he said, no, Steve Christensen was killed with a bomb. I thought Scott was kidding. I couldn't believe it. I said, no, this can't be true. He said, yes, you should come to work right now. I got to work that day, spent the day answering questions from reporters. The Salt Lake Tribune called, even national newspapers called me to ask my opinion. I resisted giving my opinion since I really didn't know anything about it, but eventually I got talked into commenting even though I didn't know anything about it. And so I remember I was interviewed on NPR saying, of course, this had nothing to do with the documents. It had everything to do with CFS, Steve Christensen's financial organization. That afternoon, as those of you who are in Salt Lake know, Mark Hoffman himself was blown up with a bomb. In a second, I then knew how wrong I had been, and that, in fact, it did have everything to do with the documents. That afternoon was chaos at the Sunstone office. Steve's father, Matt Christensen, called me to warn me that it's some crazed bomber who was after anybody having to do with the Salamander letter. I didn't have much to do with the Salamander letter, except was in part responsible for publicizing it. Lynn Jacobs strolled into our office, cool as could be, spent the afternoon there. We got calls from everywhere suggesting that we get the bomb squad sniffing out our wedding gifts, and that we ought not to go to our home that night. So we spent the night at Mike's parents'. It was a strange day, followed by stranger weeks and months. After the events of October 15th, I read news even more obsessively. I searched for information and insight to help me understand Mark Hoffman. Some news accounts helped me in that quest, others did not. In the intervening decade, quite by accident, I became a journalist myself. It is now my responsibility to report and explore such events. I have learned a lot about the profession. In many ways, I am critical of it. Like a restaurant chef who won't eat in restaurants because he knows what goes on in the kitchen, knowing journalists in newsrooms, I'm more skeptical than ever about the media. I like to think I am in it, but not of it. Journalists are opinionated. They simplify complex subjects. They use questionable sources, and they use the same ones over and over and over. But unlike some critics of the press, such as Apostle Dallin Oaks in a 1987 speech in which he accused the press of willful, quote, willful misstatements and, quote, persecuting the church, quote, I do not see conspiracy in it. Occasional hostility, yes, but much more often laziness or well-meaning ignorance. Journalists are particular people with particular biases and experiences. They report events through particular lenses. The greater the light, the better the picture. So, what is news? Oaks complained in that 1987 speech that the press reports only challenges to foundations, never supporting evidence. That is usually the case. News, by its very nature, is interested in change. Continuity or status quo is not reported as often as challenges to status quo or new interpretations of facts or old interpretations of new facts. Because newspapers focus on problems and challenges, it feels unfair and overly negative as a representation of current realities. And so it is. Law-abiding citizens are not in the paper as often as criminals, nor are the many millions who stay in the Mormon Church reported as often as the few who have been excommunicated. Sometimes the news is so filled with life's horrors that it deadens our sense of horror itself. So why do we do it? Why are we interested in this stuff? Why did Hoffman find such a ready audience for his documents? I've wondered that over and over. And I have concluded a couple of things. Obviously, It was exciting to come closer, to get what we thought was a closer glimpse of our faith's founding. I would experience the same kind of excitement if there were some first century Christian documents were recently discovered. If we could hear in what we thought were participants' own words the events of the time, that would be exciting. So I think it was legitimate that we were interested. I also think some of it was not legitimate. I think we wanted to attack official versions. We wanted to undermine simplified history. There are some who were interested in Hamar Kaufman's documents who wanted to discredit Joseph Smith, and there are others who wanted to hide the documents for fear that they would discredit Joseph Smith. I should note, of course, the curious exception to the people was Gerald and Sandra Tanner, who had every reason to be excited about the documents and who were much more cautious than many of the rest of us. They get high marks in my book for that. Mark Hoffman played to our insecurities. He preyed on our doubts and our fears. He used us. He exploited us. And we let him. From that day to this, as a journalist, each new story that I write, I must examine my motives and ask myself, what is the appeal? Why am I telling this story? Who will it help? Who will it hurt? Why am I doing it? I have learned a lot about sources. I have learned in order to describe and interpret events, you have to have people to tell you what it all means. And those people have biases. Those people have attitudes and assumptions. Whom do we trust as sources? One of the most riveting episodes in the Mark Hoffman for me was his account of an Oliver Cowdery diary that he said was in the First Presidency vault. My father has always been interested in Oliver Cowdery and has wanted to know much more about his perspective being so close into those founding events. Mark Hoffman claimed to have seen this diary in the First Presidency vault and told John Dart about it, and he wove an elaborate tale of the size of the diary and what it contained and said he had held it and seen it. John Dart wrote an article in the LA Times using an anonymous source, which turned out to be Mark Hoffman. He paid a dear price professionally for that anonymous source story. It hurt his credibility tremendously. But I can't be too critical of John Dart for doing that, because I myself interviewed Mark Hoffman for the Sunstone Review, that short-lived, wonderful periodical. I say that kiddingly, but I did love it. I interviewed Mark Hoffman. I'll never forget the interview. It was sitting in my office in the old Bennett building, and I was asking questions, and he was looking down at the paper always, not paper, but looking down at his lap while he was talking to me. I just thought, this guy is really nerdy, you know, he just doesn't have good eye contact. Now, when I look back at that interview, every answer is a lie. It's not surprising, he was looking down as he was inventing. But I didn't think to question him or challenge him on any of his statements. I took them at face value. Why did I? Why do we? How do we evaluate when we read newspapers or we read history? How do we evaluate the people who are quoted in there? One way we evaluate is by their credentials. We trust scholars, priests, prophets, or we might trust people that have identifications with ourselves. They belong to our organization, or they. I would trust someone, Sunstone editor. I would trust that person to tell me the truth as I see it. Mormons would certainly trust their leaders. Mark Hoffman knew this. He knew about those Mormon signifiers. He was often identified by having gone on a mission, been married in the temple, those kinds of things that we signal to one another that we're okay, we're in the same team. It's a system built on trust, which he exploited. when he had those signifiers so much, when he himself was blown up, a passerby noticed he was wearing temple garments, pulled out a vial of consecrated oil, and gave him a priesthood blessing on the spot. That's the kind of associations we have. Hoffman preyed on our conflicting assumptions within Mormonism. Many faithful Latter-day Saints presume that a temple-going Mormon would never lie. Some Mormon intellectuals assume that church leaders are so embarrassed by our history that they would do anything to keep them from being made public. To be fair, this was in the context in 1985 of some closing down of the historical archives, and there was reason to fear that some historical documents would be squirreled away. On the other hand, neither of those assumptions are completely fair or accurate. Whether or not you believe Gordon Hinckley was capable of buying documents and hiding them from public view is how you would interpret. If you believe that, then you would interpret events with that assumption. There are ominous and benign interpretations of President Hinckley's behavior regarding the documents. Church leaders presume the worst of the intellectual community while believing their own actions were understandable and justified, while intellectuals believe the opposite. After Hoffman's arrest, the police spent many months building a case against him. In those months, all but three Sunstone employees, and then there were about eight, including part-timers, believed he was innocent. Why did they believe he was innocent, even though he had been named as the, you know, likely suspect? The reason they believed he was innocent was because they were politically liberal. They championed the underdog, they tend to be anti-authority, and they didn't trust the police. So no matter what the police said, it didn't matter. But in fact, they were wrong and the police were right. Their assumptions about the way the world works distorted their ability to assess the information they were given. When I'm writing a story, it is really critical, once I've found people that I consider to be reliable sources, to ask them a lot of questions, to cover every possible angle. And why is that? Because people don't volunteer information, generally speaking, don't volunteer information that you haven't asked for. In the midst of the Hoffman investigation, at issue, of course, was the purported McClellan collection. Hoffman claimed to have it. He sold it to several different parties. Well, it turned out when people began investigating, and the church said that they did not have it. But it turns out the church did have it, which they discovered in the midst of the investigation. They discovered that they had it after they had been asked if they had it and responded no. So Dallin Oaks again concluded, well, maybe we'll volunteer these McClellan collection during the trial period. But since the trial never happened, they never volunteered that information. And when he was confronted about that, he said, well, no one asked. I find that troubling, but it fits with what I know about people, human beings. My experience with sources is that they do not volunteer information of a controversial nature unless you think to ask. They may not even know that it's controversial. I mean, it may not be purposeful withholding. It may simply be a case of not connecting up that you need that information. Context and connections are everything when you're trying to write a fair account of events. I'll tell you, my first day on the job as a reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune, again, you got to remember, I was not trained in this. I didn't go to school to study it. I just did it all by instinct. First day on the job, I was sent to a press conference wherein the Southern Baptist Convention announced they had chosen Salt Lake City for their 1998 convention, which includes many thousands of people, maybe 30, 40,000 people, Southern Baptists coming to Salt Lake City. So I went to the press conference, and I was the only one there. So I asked some questions, and then they gave me their statements. And all the way back to the office, I kept saying to myself, why are the Southern Baptists coming to Salt Lake City? Why would they choose here? They hate Mormons. This doesn't make any sense to me. I would run it over and over in my mind, and then finally I decided just to call them up and put it to them straight, you know. I called up their spokesperson, and I said, why are you coming to Salt Lake City in 1998? You hate Mormons. And this guy, of course, said, well, we don't hate Mormons, but we do have some theological differences. And he said, although we have these theological differences, we really like Utah's abortion laws. And so it occurred to me at that moment that theological differences can be set aside for political and social similarities. That's how I wrote the story, and that made a better story, because I sought and found the connections and the meaning behind a simple statement. That is what we need to do with all our stories, although the press of daily deadlines rarely gives us the chance to do such thinking. It is critical to understand both Hoffman and the church's actions in their overlapping contexts. Many journalists at the time failed to do that. There are 100 different ways to tell the same story. Whose quotes get the most weight? How is it organized, top to bottom? You've got to know that most readers won't read beyond your first two paragraphs, so you put your most important stuff at the very top if you want to be sure that they'll listen to it. And even when I think I'm being very careful, I know more about a story the day after it runs than the day it ran. I'll give you another example. I got a call one Thursday afternoon from a seventh grader who told me that she had been assigned to write a biography of a hero, someone whom she considered a hero, and she chose Jesus, and her teacher wouldn't let her. Did I consider that a story? I did. I said, yeah, I'll write about that story. So next morning I called the teacher, and she said, oh, no, she misunderstood the assignment. She's a difficult pupil. We have this difficult relationship. Please don't write this story. This is my first year of being a teacher. I said, well, would it be okay for her to write that biography, you know, if that were the assignment? She said, oh, I can't talk about that. Please, you'll have to call the principal. So I called the principal, and same thing. She said, no, you're threatening this teacher. She's a good teacher. The student misunderstood the assignment. I said, well, would it be all right for her to write a book report, choose Jesus as her hero? The principal said, no, that would be inappropriate. Intrusion of religion in the classroom. I said, what about Muhammad? She said, no. I said, Buddha? She said, no, no, no. We don't want any of that religion stuff in our classroom. So I wrote the story. I said, this teacher doesn't understand that this is permissible in the classroom. I thought I had the story right. I was fair. I gave every side of it good play. Two things happened. First of all, something I have nothing to do with, which is the picture. They went to this girl's house and took a picture of her at her house sitting in front of a giant, oversized picture of Jesus, which tipped the story, right, in favor of the girl, against the teacher. So then the next day I got a lot of hostile phone calls from other pupils, from teachers, saying I had picked on this teacher, she was a first-year teacher, and so on and so forth. Meanwhile, the students picked on that student. She was heckled. She was driven out of the class. She was harassed, all because of my story. Did I tell the truth that day? Did I understand that story? Did I do right? I don't know. That story troubles me. I wish I had more time. I wish I could have talked to more teachers, more students, fleshed it out, understood motives, understood relationships. I knew none of that when I wrote that story. And so we come to Washington Post editor Ben Bradley, recently is fond of quoting in his recent book, newspapers are the rough drafts of history. Because of all I've learned about journalism, this makes me wary of historians who rely too much on newspapers. Historians definitely take more time. they definitely have a chance to think about it all in a way that newspaper reporters don't. Nevertheless, historians as well have their biases, their assumptions. They often take leaps of logic. They connect disparate facts that ought not to be connected. They create pictures that would be unrecognizable to the participants themselves. For example, do historians writing about religious figures believe in the supernatural? Is it possible for people to have supernatural experiences? If it's not possible, then how can you write about people who believe in it? And what is your assumption? What are your assumptions about the protagonists in the historical events? There are four books about the Hoffman murders. There's Salamander, there's Mormon Murders, Gathering of Saints, and Victims. All of them contain factual accuracy, some factual errors, but by and large, even Mormon Murders, which I know a lot of people have faulted for some of its errors, nevertheless, it has a fair amount of accuracy in some of its aspects. The first, Salamander, and the last, Victims, are good complementary books. I think the title, Victims, is an unfortunate one, but it clearly reflects the church's self-view of being a victim. They see themselves as victims. Taken together, the two books help us understand the events better. One without the other is like hearing only one side of a divorce. That brings me to Scripture. Scripture, particularly the New Testament, let's say, in the gospel accounts of Jesus' life, it's both history and doctrine. New Testament accounts of Jesus' life have striking parallels to the enterprise of journalism in history. Most scholars believe the writers were not eyewitnesses to the events, but drew upon oral traditions from eyewitness events to compile their versions. That each man colored the account is undeniable. Each had an agenda or a bias is clear. But how you receive the accounts depends on your assumptions. Were these men preserving an accurate picture of Jesus' life as if they were trying to... were they preserving an accurate picture of Jesus' life, or were they trying to defend church practices, Christian church practices, that had developed later? People in the Jesus Seminar, which is something I write about twice a year when it happens, they send me this press release, so I write a story about their enterprise, believe that miracles are not possible, or at least not explainable, and therefore they reject all biblical miracles as unhistorical. They send me press releases, as I said, twice a year. They've concluded no virgin birth, no resurrection, no this, no that. I get the press release, I say, duh, what do you expect them to conclude? No surprises in their work to me, because their assumptions are so obvious. There's no subtlety about it. What amazes me about the gospel accounts is that they have held their truth for more than 2,000 years. Most Christians believe the Bible stories really happened in much the way they are written. I'm also intrigued that the New Testament compilers put together four different accounts of the same stories, sometimes with conflicting information. One person will include one aspect of Jesus' life or teaching, another one. Why do they do that? That says to me that it requires multiple telling to get at the truths, multiple telling of the same stories, the same events, much like the Hoffman books. Mark Hoffman stole my innocence from me. I now know firsthand that evil exists, that people are not always what they claim to be, that people lie. I think I was innocent, sort of a naive Mormon before that, always looking for the good, giving people the benefit of the doubt. I interviewed Mark Hoffman. I didn't know him well, but I had a firsthand experience with evil. He exploited the naivety and assumptions of good people and turned them against each other. I no longer revere the printed word. Since Hoffman, and now with my job, I am more skeptical than ever about what is printed in newspapers and books. Like my parents, I recognize the biases in the New York Times, but unlike them, I do not believe there is a paper or writer without such biases. And the assumptions slant the piece so much it is little more than propaganda for one view, but I recognize it even when it is subtle. I'm skeptical about truth claims and motives. I'm constantly assessing my own motives and other people's. Why are they writing this? Why are we playing it when we do, where we do? Why is this source so insistent on our writing it? What does he or she have to gain? Do they have financial interest, emotional interest, spiritual interest? I am aware of history written from a 20th century agenda, or one that that has limiting secular assumptions about religious people, or contrarily, ones that underestimate the selfishness or the dark side. But even as I grow critical of journalists and historians, I am more appreciative than ever of the gospel writers. I frankly don't know how they did it. I certainly could not. It makes me believe more than I ever have in the divinity behind these books. God was involved in the transmission of the faith, the writing, and the compiling. It is writing I seek but will never finally accomplish. Thank you. Do we have a few minutes? Do you want, anybody got Salt Lake questions? The question is, have I interviewed Mark Hoffman since then? He does not take interviews since then. In fact, I did try to do, before the bombings, I tried to do a second interview with him, and he said no, he'd gotten too much publicity, and he just didn't think he would want to do that. You know, he was in the midst of all that stuff, but no, I haven't. Many people did try at the time of the 10-year anniversary. People put in requests for an interview, but he didn't grant any of them. Yes.
Do you have any idea of his currency or what kind of person he
has? We don't get many reports of him, to tell you the truth, in Salt Lake. He's quite reclusive. You know, he did have a suicide attempt and in prison. And that was, but that was before I was, I think that was before I was back in Utah. And he seems to be doing all right now in terms of, you know. Oh, yes. He was at the parole board met a year after he was in and said that he would not be up again for parole, that he's in jail for life. Yes. Yes, it did. I thought the man is incredibly greedy. I mean, I did. I remember thinking that. But he's not the first greedy Mormon I've ever met. So, you know, I didn't think he was greedy and, you know, totally pathological. You know, I just thought he was simply greedy. Yes.
What happened to his family?
As far as... Oh, sorry. What's happening with his family... His wife and children. He's divorced. His wife is divorced from him, but I think there's still some kind of association with the children. He's got four. Can't remember, boys and girls, a couple of each, I think. So he still has some association, as far as I know. Yes. Well, it's a continuum. I mean, it's easy to pick on the more blatant examples like hard copy and say, now that's not real journalism, it's sensationalism. But what I'm trying to tell you is that that kind of mentality exists throughout professional journalism. Let me give you an example. We actually had a copy editor at our paper, Salt Lake Tribune, night copy person, who came up upon a story that was an inch too short. So he made up a quote and stuck it on the bottom of the story. The stupid thing was, he made up a quote. If I were making up a quote, which I wouldn't, but if I did, he chose Robert Redford. He made up a Robert Redford quote. Did he think that the publicist wasn't going to call the next day and say, you know, when did you talk to Mr. Redford, you know, about this? And He was fired on the spot. However, the fact that he even considered doing that tells you how far we've come. I mean, I don't want to say that journalism in the past was wonderful and now it isn't, because I think that's misleading. I think actually it's more honest today that people have signed articles. So you know my name is on an article. You can kind of figure out what my assumptions are and where I'm coming from, and I have to stand by my own stories because I have my name on them. Whereas in the past, they were, of course, all unsigned, and you had to deduce kind of assumptions. So I'm not saying it's all terrible now and it was wonderful in the past, but we make choices every single day, hundreds of choices about what story is going to be out front, what's going to be in the top two paragraphs, who we're going to quote, and that the cumulative effect is bias. So let's not point fingers at hard copy. Hard copy wouldn't sell if the consumers didn't want it. And that's, you know, so I can nail myself, but all of us are guilty of tuning in and therefore creating the market for it. Yes. You know, I okay. All right. Okay, this gentleman's saying that as a group, his experience is that with philosophers or mathematicians, the two you named, tend to be highly educated, fairly intelligent. Intelligent. Okay, not highly educated, intelligent. And as a group, journalists tend not to be as intelligent. Fair? Okay. You know, I don't think that's true. As hard as I've been on my profession, I would say there are people in the profession who are as smart as anybody. Any academics. I think what you get in an academic field, you get time. You get time to really hone those ideas with study and work. And you don't put work out in an academic journal until you have really, you know, mastered it or at least spent a lot of time thinking about it. Journalists, on the other hand, are incredibly productive. I would say, I never thought I could say this, but in the last 4 years, I've written more than 800 stories. Think about that for a second. It's an incredible productivity level. And therein lies the problem with the product. But journalists tend to be broad in their interests. You've got to jump back and forth to lots of different topics. I cover religion, which is a specific beat, and yet I cover Buddhism, I cover Mormonism, I cover Judaism, I cover Catholicism, and I can't be an expert in all of those fields at the same level as a philosopher could be an expert in one little tiny piece of academic life. That's what makes them seem not as intelligent, I think, to you, is that there's not the depth, there's more breadth that they have to cover and jump around a lot. The best journalists are as bright as or brighter than the best of any field, and the worst or the mediocre are about the same. The difference is journalists who are not bright or who are not dedicated or not honest have a lot more power than philosophers. They do, because I can write a piece today and it can be on 100,000 doorsteps tomorrow. And whether you think I'm smart or not, you'll read it, and it'll, you know. And that's power, and that's a difference. Well, that's another one of those things that if you talk to five people, they'll tell you five different things. Okay, my opinion is, is it true that the church was relieved at the plea bargain with Mark Hoffman in order that it not have to testify? Is that?
Yeah,
or shut down the story, shut down the conversation about the story. I'm sure their church leaders were relieved not to have to testify. They weren't probably not looking forward to that. It's not a situation they would feel comfortable doing. On the other hand, that's a real simplistic view of the plea bargain. It was a very complex, reasoned decision on the part of the defense and the prosecution. When I did a story about, you know, the 10-year Hoffman 10 years later, I talked to police and prosecutors, and they are really offended when people presume that a church somehow strong-armed them into that plea bargain, because they did it, they believe, for the good of the family and for the good of justice, that a trial would not have gotten any better. I mean, that they would not have been able to get a better, more just arrangement out of a trial than they got with the plea bargain, since he's in prison for life. They didn't think they could get the death penalty, weren't even going to try, given that, you know, they didn't have enough evidence tying him to the murders. They had plenty of evidence on the forgeries, but the murders, they didn't feel like they had enough to go. So I don't think it's fair to tell you the truth, which is not to say that the church leaders weren't relieved. I'm sure they were. Lori. Oh, sure, can I comment on the new Episcopal bishop, whose name is Carolyn Tanner Irish, who's the daughter of O.C. Tanner, and she's become an Episcopal priest and now is about to become the Episcopal bishop of Utah in May. I went to Washington and interviewed her at length, and fascinating woman. I think it's a very good thing for Utah, because she has nothing but fond, positive feelings about the Mormon Church, and she's going to shake things up a little bit. She's not controversial in that way. She's very gentle of manner, but she's very strong. She's the chairman of the board, CEO of O.C. Tanner, so she's got plenty of business expertise. She has her Mormon upbringing, and although the Mormon Church has gotten involved, really involved in sort of ecumenical type things in Utah at the highest level, even, you know, Gordon Hinckley and the Catholic Bishop George Niederauer have had occasion to meet and talk, and they get together. And now at that highest level, there'll be a woman, and that will be different for Utah. So, yes. No. I think that's a misperception people have. The paper is pressured. We feel the community response to things. And I will tell you that the way that they try to exert pressure is by sending public relations representatives over to complain. If they don't like a story, they come over and say to the editor whatever their complaint is. But in terms of actually pressuring us, no.
I think our time is up, Peggy.
Okay, thank you.